But I thought it's now unfortunately true that many people that know a lot about the family and the farm and other dimensions are dead and dying off pretty fast. And I have some background of data that I would be guilty if I die off without having left some record or some reminder of what aspects I thought were important. Now I'm going to stop and let you see whether you can hear me.
Okay, people on either the phone or the Skype, holler if you're having trouble hearing Phil.
I can hear him.
Well, this is Paul, and I'm not on the phone. I am on Skype, and I hear you just fine.
Okay, so nobody's reporting trouble?
Someone just spoke up. Who was that?
This is Corky. You're loud and clear.
All right.
Okay. Well,
what about Joe? Is he online?
Yeah, I'm on the conference call. I can hear.
Good. Okay. Karen, can you hear okay?
Yes, I can.
All right. Phil, take it away.
Well, these comments are going to be a little hectic because they're not very well articulated, not very well hooked up. But I have had several people talk with me about the farm and the house and the farming activity. And I want to start off with commenting on the fact that the house was built in 1913. Mother and Dad moved in not immediately. They lived in what was later turned into a bunkhouse for hired labor, and lived there for several months before the farmhouse was done. But by and large, they were in their new house in 1914 when I was born. So that the house age is probably from 1914. Parenthetically, let me mention something on that score. There were a number of photos made of the construction of the house and the barn.
It's Chris. I'm sorry I'm late.
Oh, good. Welcome to the show.
Hello.
Okay, continue going, Phil.
So we had the local bank, the Timken State Bank, had a collection of pictures of farmsteads in their trade territory, and included were pictures of the construction of the house and the barn on the farm in Rush County, Kansas. I have seen the collection, but never put together at any one time. It was scattered among several different householders, and the bank had some. So that you can get building history from that collection of pictures. They were at one time on display in the bank before it closed, and the cashier for the bank had put the display together. So I suppose it could be done again. At any rate, I wanted to start off with comments about the early days of Ralph's in Rush County, Kansas. I was baptized in the house by my grandfather, my dad's father, Gustav Philip Raup, who had come out to Kansas to visit his new grandson. I was the first grandson in the family up to that time. And they had taken him over to visit with John Cruz, K-R-U-S-E, who had been significantly responsible for the whole move. In this way, Cruz was a member of a German team of landscape architects that had been hired to work on the exposition in St. Louis, I think in 1904, the celebration of the Louisiana Purchase. And he was impressed with the fact that there was so much land available that he, Cruz himself, went back to Springfield, Ohio to visit with the owners of this land, who were the three,
three daughters?
You're fine.
They were the daughters of Ross Mitchell.
Hey, Chris.
Okay. Yeah, people should mute their phone if you can. It's not too bad, but there's some sounds coming through. Unfortunately, we can't mute on our side or Phil wouldn't come through.
I suppose I could call this a technical problem, but some of you know my thumb was torn off in 1970. Corky, you helped pick up the pieces.
Oh, yeah.
And it has suddenly started to bleed in the last couple of days, and it just started again right now. So in addition to all the running around here, I've got a bloody thumb that I'm trying to take care of. At any rate, let me get back to my thesis here.
You do.
Oh, now the doctors are going to go to work.
We're doing a little medical attention here, if you'll just hold on for a second. Oh my gosh.
Don't put...
Yeah, you can't put pressure on
press.
It.
Press. Unanticipated interruptions.
I'll get some more.
No, that's not the right. Okay. Kleenex? Do we have paper towels in here?
We've got Kleenex.
Sorry, but I think we can live with what we've fixed up here. John Cruz, K-R-U-S-E, was one of a group of German horticulturalists who had been hired to work with the planners of the St. Louis Exposition celebrating the Louisiana Purchase. And he went back to having arrived in St. Louis and having seen the land available, he went back to Ohio to meet with Ross Mitchell and the others who had been landowners and had held some Kansas land. Now this is complicated because Ross Mitchell himself died, I think, in 1913, and my grandfather, Gustav Philip Raup, my father's father, died just about 6 weeks after they had visited us in Kansas, where he baptized his new grandson. So that there were hectic events associated with the inheritance of that land and the management of it. Ross Mitchell's death resulted in the property being divided three ways between Fanny Mitchell Raup, Effie and Addie Mae Greenewald, Effie Shuey. So what started out as a unitary holding of Ross Mitchell turned into a three-way split between the Shuey and the Greenewald and the Raup family. And the part that was Raup was taken over and managed by Harry Raup, my uncle, who was who became the manager of the land for the other members of the Ross Mitchell family. So that event, that sequence of succession occurred in a very short time span. It was not very easy to get things organized and the transfer and property rights completed because of the outbreak of the First World War. So that while all this was going on, there was the confusion associated with the taxation and the financing of the war. You remember that this era coincided with the establishment and management of the Federal Reserve banking system, so that there was plenty of ground for mix-up and confusion. I started out with a reference to John Cruz, who had wanted to buy some Ross Mitchell land. Wound up that what he was dealing with was the heirs of Mitchell who died, and of Gus Raup, who died, and not fortunately, Ed Shuey and Greenewald were still living at that time, by this time, so that there had been a succession, a rapid fire succession of owners of the land and of people who would be responsible for managing it. In abbreviated form, Jim Rout, my father, took over two sections, and Harry Raup, his brother, my uncle, took over the management of the Greenewald and Shuey land and the rest of the Raup land. It was Jim, my father, took over on only two sections, and there were other Raup lands. In total, Ross Mitchell owned about 6,000 acres. That's a very rough figure, but that was divided up then between three families, and within the Raup family, between several of the children, my aunts and uncles. All this, as you can understand, made for a lot of confusion and difficulty, especially in terms of the financial structure that emerged and the market structure, in that while this transition, Ross Mitchell dying in 1913, Gus Raup dying in 1914, and the World War I taking place, we had quite a bit of uncertainty about management and about who owned what. One consequence was that the Ross Mitchell land, that is the total, these 6,000 acres, if I'm measuring it rightly, were broken out and farmed at different times by different owners and operators. One significant consequence was that the land that Jim Raup took over, my father, was one of the few pieces of the original Ross Mitchell holding that were being farmed as a unit. So my dad sweet-talked my mother into joining him in Kansas on a pretty isolated farm while she was in the custom design department of Marshall Field's new store in Chicago. So it was a big change for her. But she made it, and that's how come I was born in Kansas. So that as a little boy, I have very vivid memories of John Cruz, the German landscape architect. I think that's too fancy a title to have used in those days. Was a big part of my early childhood. I remember going over to the Cruises to celebrate Christmas because Mrs. Cruz made the most wonderful Christmas cookies. She was German. And those dimensions of my early life have been very influential in later life. I want to shift gears now and take up another subject. John Cruz was an influential man throughout the years that I was on the farm and until his death, which I think was in 32 or 33. I remember that he is buried in the graveyard of the Lutheran Church south of Albert, Kansas, and straight west of Great Bend, Kansas. And one of my vivid childhood memories was that the hearse broke down because it was a dust storm, and we had to tow the hearse to the graveyard for the burial ceremonies. That characterized the dust storm period of the 30s, and a lot of uncertainty was compounded by the fact that the land use pattern that was developed in the first decades of the 20th century, and that was accelerated and distorted by the demand structure for wheat in the First World War, had led to an extension of cultivated land and of sod breaking that put a lot of land under the plow and in cultivation that probably on more sober and much less hectic circumstances would not have been farmed. That is a part of the history of the Dust Bowl. Too much was plowed, and it was plowed too hurriedly, too fast, so that the stage was set for the dust storms of the 1930s by the excessive land use practices of the 1915 and 16 and 18 and 20s. So that era has a very strange history of origin, and it was specifically remember, these were my teenagers. So, I now shift to another dimension, and that was district number 66 of the country school system, Rabbit Ridge School. That is of some significance right now, because it was named Rabbit Ridge in part because a number of the acres of land in that area were owned by my great-grandfather, Ross Mitchell, and then later farmed by my father, who had, by this time, had mechanical equipment, internal combustion engines and steam engines that could do a lot of damage to the land and quickly, in a hurry, so that the land was not only the sod broken, but it was broken hastily, and while it's very questionable whether you should be smart after the fact, it was broken too quickly. But I shift now to another dimension, and that is my own schooling. I graduated from high school in May of 1931. I have some statistics at home that show that that was the worst possible time to enter the labor force in 100 years. And it meant that what had been planned and had been drummed into me that I was going to go to college, by the time it came, I became eligible to go to college, we were broke. And so I was out of college for 3 years. Those were the years in which I worked on the Fisher Body Craftsman's Guild competition by building a model coach. We have the model coach. That was also the period in which I developed stomach ulcer. So it takes some skill to develop a stomach ulcer at 19. And that was my situation. One consequence is that we have some very good health records of my health, beginning with age 15 and peaking with stomach ulcers as I was graduating from high school. So that I've thought a lot about that, because one consequence has been that I was then taught to chew every bite carefully, and that makes me a very slow eater. It still does. And people get impatient joining me for a meal, because I don't chew and swallow fast enough. But one consequence of that is that I have the same weight now, my 96th birthday, that I had when I graduated from high school. And I have the medical documentation to support it. One consequence of all this is that I grew very conscious of the significance of slow eating, and it has affected my social life and my family life, and you will be very appreciative of that. I just want you to know that I'm aware of it. Now, I'll shift gears again by saying I purposely asked Gordon and Martha and Philip, who are here in the room, to forego questions. But that doesn't mean that I don't want them. It means that I'm not confident of my ability to think fast enough and take care of the questions without it being an interruption. So if you have questions or some of these comments, please put them in writing and send me a note. I can read slowly, but it's a lot better than trying to handle oral questions over all these gadgets that are around me here. Do we have time to ask for questions now? Mm-hmm. If some of you are hooked up with something you can answer on, please do. Now.
No. So you're willing to entertain questions?
How much time do we?
Well, we have until people leave. There is no set time.
Yes, I'll be happy to hear some questions.
Okay, the floor is open for questions from the audience.
Uncle Phil, I'm a little confused. Did Cruz actually get land in the Kansas area and live there? Is that how you went over for cookies?
Did you hear the question?
Did Cruz actually live in the Kansas area?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. John Cruz lived a mile and a half from Section 25. We had Sections 15 and 11. And he was still, he lived there as long as his whole life, which, as I said, terminated about 1932. Cruz was, we found out something to my surprise just yesterday, that there is an archive of information about the celebration in St. Louis of the St. Louis celebration was the
Louisiana
Purchase. And there is an archival record of that and of data supplied by John Cruz in the University Archives at Berkeley, California. I didn't know that. But if somebody has access to the archives in Berkeley, I would be very interested in finding out what they know about John Cruz, because he was a landscape architect that was hired and brought to St. Louis, and incidentally explains why there's so substantial a German community around St. Louis.
This is Corky. How did John Cruz meet Ross Mitchell?
The question is, how did John Cruz meet Ross Mitchell?
Ross Mitchell.
I don't know. I think could everybody hear the question?
Yeah.
Yeah, I repeated it.
You see, the exhibition, the exposition in St. Louis that John Cruz was hired to advise on landscape architect, was 1904. Louisiana Purchase was 1903. So that there's some time lag in there. I don't know when he went back to Ohio to talk with my grandfather, Gus Raup, about buying some Kansas land. My dad talked with me, I remember conversations with him, about the fact that it was Ross Mitchell, it was Gus, John Cruise's visit to Gus Raup in Springfield, Ohio, that alerted or stimulated interest in developing the Kansas land, which had been in the Mitchell family hands for some 20 or 30 years. Before that, I have section 11 of Township 19, Range 17. That was open and unfarmed for 30 years after Mitchell bought it. Incidentally, I can think of all kinds of topics for some research here. Ross Mitchell must have been in contact with his fellow Ohio industrial colleagues who formed the Timken Roller Bearing Corporation, after which Timken, Kansas is named. And when I was a little boy, there was still a Timken Ranch at that location. So somebody could do some good digging by hunting up heirs of the Timken family and find what do they know about their role. Because it looks to me like that Ross Mitchell had contacted, was in contact with his contemporary Timken. I don't even know his first name. Who had apparently bought some Kansas land from the Santa Fe Railroad at about the same time that Ross Mitchell was buying Kansas land from the Santa Fe Railroad. Okay, next.
This is Chris Rapp. I'm just curious about Richard Cruz's ethnic heritage. Cruz sounds a little bit like a Mexican name, but you said he married a German, so I was wondering if you knew
Cruz?
Any history about him.
No, Cruz?
Yes.
He's very German. The K-R-U-S...
A little bit of an unusual name for a German, so how's it spelled?
K-R-U-S-E.
Okay.
And they were a delightful German couple. Mind you, this was before the First World War, and the status and reputation of Germans in the United States was quite different than it became later, say in the 1920s, or more specifically in the 1940s. So that Cruz was an influential man in his community, and he attracted some new settlers who came and bought some of the land held by the Ross Mitchell's other heirs. Incidentally, I have something to mention in this regard. I am finding out the dimensions of aging, and it's quite true that you deteriorate at the margins. margins in the sense of feet, eyes, ears, teeth, and a whole lot of component parts. One side comment there that is particularly relevant for me right now. I'm in this retirement, assisted living home in St. Paul, and I'm being very generously treated by friends who will come and pick me up and take me places. The main dimension of aging in our culture is you no longer can drive a car. And that's being excommunicated in a very realistic sense. So if you have to get other people to provide your wheels, it's a tremendous shift. We need some kind of a ceremony to mark the when you lose your driver's license. We have all kinds of coming of age ceremonies associated with getting your driver's license. And we have, I notice it in that I am being picked up by young squirts of 75 years of age in sport utility vehicles that I can't get into. They have to help me climb into the vehicles. And the grab bars that I'm supposed to hold on to are made for some climate other than Minnesota, because you can't grab them with gloves there on. Okay, next.
Could you tell us a little about your time in Germany after the war? Your first arrivals, things like that?
Do we want to save that to another time? I'm just worried that that kind of opens up a whole broad dimension that we haven't even started to get into. Phil, what do you think?
Well, there's so much. You probably don't want to get me started.
Yeah. Well, I'm wondering if there's any more questions about this time period in the early farm history.
I would like to make a comment. Joe Ward has just sent me a link of information that people may find interesting, and I think in the future we can share this type of information. It's an article from Springfield and Clark County talking about on May 28th,
hello,
Reverend Raup was united in marriage with Miss Fanny Mitchell, daughter of Ross Mitchell of Springfield, and to their union 11 children as follows. So, Joe, why don't you, well, I'll send this link out to everybody else. And I think if anyone else finds information that may be of interest, we should continue to do that.
When was, what was the year?
Of this article?
No, of their marriage.
I don't know. I'd have to look.
Well, I had a question. I don't know if you can hear me. If any of this land, you're saying this was bought from the railroad. They were not homesteaders then. Is that correct?
Well,
it's not under the Homestead Act.
Yes, it was. Mm-hmm. And a lot of it was bought. You know, the railroads in those days had a large crew of salesmen, recruiters would be a better term, who tried to persuade people to come to the United States and buy railroad land cheaply, which it was, relatively speaking. The Raup land, I have the the deed for the section I own, and I think it was acquired from the railroad for about $1.50 an acre, and then it was sold very soon thereafter, and the price got up to $4 an acre by the time Ross Mitchell bought it. And I presume what was going on was some hanky-panky within the railroad company, maybe, or dealers, brokers that were handling the sale to Ross Mitchell. Got a sucker on the line here. Let's shift the gears and jack up the price. But what I own, which is one section, was shifted at $4 an acre, approximately.
Now, this is Bill again. You had mentioned before that one of the key things in the farm was when Jim Raup went out to the exposition in San Francisco and they saw the first mechanical reapers.
Yes. Yes.
Could you just...
I are we on?
Yeah.
I surely missed the ball there because I wanted to say something about it and forgot. My dad, Jim Raup, and his brother, Harry Raup, went out to the Panama Pacific Exposition.
Can you still hear that?
In San Francisco.
Speak up.
And they had it's really funny. You need a scenario writer here while I'm having trouble with linking into the electronics here. I'm also having trouble with my thumb, which is bleeding all over the place, and so I have to try to stop the bleeding and start the talking. So we have, what was your question?
We were talking about the Pan American Exposition San Francisco.
Yeah, Dad and Uncle Harry went out to San Francisco to this Panama Pacific Exposition. I think it was an outgrowth of the Panama Canal. And they saw combine harvesters in California and got the idea that maybe they should be growing wheat in Kansas and harvesting it with mechanical means. Up to that time, the harvest was in the form of swathing, cutting it and it lays over, and then you come along and bundle it into bundles. That was often a woman's job.
By hand.
Then the mechanical binder was invented. Incidentally, Ross Mitchell was influential in that. He was a farm machinery inventor. So that many of the tools that it took to mechanize the grain harvest were tools that were especially suited to wheat growing. One important fact of the evolution of technology in the United States is that it rolled from the west to the east, so that the wheat belt was mechanized sometime before the corn belt was. The Wheat Belt was further west into the Great Plains. And California wheat fields and some of the Palouse area in Oregon, Washington, were also mechanized, so that the heavy, almost universal use of tractors instead of horses or oxen was a role that an event that swept from west to east in the United States. In most of Europe, it was from the industrialized area to the fringe area. Now here it was from the fringe into the more.
So you were saying that the person, the manufacturer of the mechanized harvester was not sure, or they wanted to just try it out in Kansas because they had used it mainly in California.
Yes.
And so they worked out some kind of a deal to provide this to Jim Rao?
Yeah. That's, thank you. I neglected that. Corky will have some records in his, in my dad's files, of the fact that when he bought his first combine harvester, I think it was in 1914, and it arrived in 1915. It was a high-risk operation. He had to pay cash for the whole cost and prepay the freight.
Wow.
So the company, there were no circles of farm equipment dealers in those days. It was kind of a financial arrangement between the individual and the Holt, H-O-L-T, manufacturing company. And so Dad has, there are records at the farm now of the fact that a part of his purchase arrangement was an agreement to provide room and board for employees of the combine manufacturer so they could study its operation and its use in the Great Plains. They had, which was a very cagey inclusion in the contract, because to mechanize agriculture in America, you had to change agriculture, and different seeds were required, different plant sequences, different plant life spans, so that the wheat there are works of art in the museums that show wheat as high as a man's head. And the reason was there was a dual use for the wheat, grain and straw. Straw was a fodder for horses and a roofing material for roofs and bedding material for beds, so that the product, your profit from a wheat yield in a season would be a mix of grain and straw. And early wheats were tall and had long straws. And that will show, that does show up today if you attend some of the, or visit some of the historical villages and farms in Europe. I'm thinking specifically of Finland, Sweden, Denmark, Germany. When I say that, I visited farms there in which straw was still a very valuable component of growing wheat, and tall wheats were considered desirable. Premium. And I am old enough now to have remembered the early days in wheat growing in Kansas when they were using pre-mechanical straw length as a criterion. And we have some pictures in our collection of my dad and his and some of his brothers visiting him and walking through the wheat field, and it's up above his shoulders.
Wow. That, so that changed with the mechanical harvesting.
Yes. Yes. And with the it changed for several reasons. One was the height of the length of the straw, and what you did with it. Did you bundle it? Were you going to bundle it, or are you going to run it through a steam-driven threshing machine, or if you're going to take it through a combine, modern, the shorter the better. Mm-hmm. And so. Norman Borlaug, Minnesota's famous Nobel Prize winner in developing dwarf wheats, took some of the wheats that had been developed for early use with mechanical equipment and shortened them even more. So that Borlaug's work in making dwarf wheat in Mexico at his experiment station was another phase of this sequence of getting away from wheat, straw as a fodder or a bedding in a dairy barn, or roofing material. Mm-hmm. But we didn't, I guess you could say that Norman Borlaug and his work with the dwarf wheats was the final nail in the coffin of straw as a roofing material. And therefore you didn't want it long.
Right. So I wonder if we want to keep going?
Well, I do have one follow-up question. Phil, you talked about Jim going to the West Coast, to, was it San Francisco?
Yeah.
To an exposition. Was that before or after they moved to the farm?
Before.
So this was, he got the idea for mechanical farming as a predecessor to getting the farm.
I don't know that this is pure speculation.
Well, Phil just said that he went before the farm.
The exposition, he said, was in 1916, and the farm was was 1909. Or
yeah. What year was the exposition?
I think.
Diane.
1910.
1910.
I think.
So it was several years before he got the land. And do we know, or are you just surmising, that he got the idea for becoming a wheat farmer from seeing the mechanical equipment in San Francisco?
Well, I think he was tremendously impressed by what he saw when he went out to the Penn Pacific Exposition in San Francisco. Plus the fact that that was pretty close. I'm not sure what time span was involved, but Mr. Cruz had just come to Springfield and to try to persuade Ross Mitchell to sell some of that land. So,
do you think Ross Mitchell asked Jim to farm?
No,
because Jim was in Chicago. Where was Jim? Was living in Chicago at this time, wasn't he?
He was a
bookkeeper.
Accountant.
An accountant. He was an early CPA. Baker Vauter Accounting Company. The firm still exists. I visited with some of the officials in Chicago.
Okay.
Well,
we should maybe cut it off. We could probably go on for hours, but I don't know if Phil can keep talking.
You want to ask a question?
Phil asks if there's any more questions.
But I sure want to wish Uncle Phil a happy birthday, and I've sure enjoyed listening to this. I'm very, very interested in any and all information anybody would like to email me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I think there were a couple people talking there for a second. Did somebody else come through the audio conference?
I asked what was the name of the firm that Jim was the accountant at.
Baker, B-A-K-E-R, Vauter. I'm not dead sure how that's spelled. I think it was V-A-U-T-E-R. Accounting Company, State Street, Chicago. I visited with them some years ago, like 50 years ago.
Well, they must still be in existence. Okay, let's wrap it up for tonight. Thanks, everybody, for attending. And thank you, Phil, for a wonderful lecture.
Well, I just feel a little comfortable having been able to talk with you about these things, because I'll be gone shortly.
Or not so.
Well, we hope not. But we'll wrap it up for today. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you for making it possible.
Happy birthday.